If you're listening to this sitting around the campfire, now, I know, one person can't really sit around the campfire unless you're quite tall and you arrange yourself in a circle. That would be lying down around the campfire. That wouldn't be sitting around the campfire. If you had very long legs, I suppose, arrange yourself so the campfire is between the legs. You're getting too close to the fire there. I don't recommend that at all. Especially if you're flammable. But if you happen to be listening to this while seated at a campfire, possibly you're in the scouts. You're not a child scout, because this program isn't for children. But you might be a scout leader supervising a camping weekend with your scouts. You're sitting around this campfire. It's well past bedtime. It's 9 o'clock at night, but you're camping, so there's no beds. Everyone has to go into a tent. So if you're going to sleep on the ground in some tent, first thing you want to do before you go to bed is to make sure you're very tired so you can sleep. And the way you become very tired is to sit at the campfire and have them listen to your shit for an hour. Tell them ghost stories or something. That's probably what you do. I've never been camping with the scouts. I was in the Beaver Cubs until I was 6 and a half. We didn't go camping. I think we were considered too young. You turn up at some campsite. You take out these tents out of the back of the bus. Then you climb into them and you set up all these beds, or whatever the camping equivalent of beds is. Sleeping bag and a ground sheet and hopefully nothing flammable. Again, you don't want to have flammable things inside a tent. No cigarettes. I suppose you might have a gas stove. That's part of the camping experience, isn't it? We had them. It was only for power cuts. This little blue bottle of gas, stick a pot on top of it and say, oh, look, I'm feeding my family and I don't even have a functional cooker or electricity. I just have this. We're basically living like in the Stone Age. It's exactly like the beginning of 2001 A Space Odyssey. I don't know if you've ever seen 2001 A Space Odyssey. It's not set in space. That's the first surprise that comes as soon as you start watching it. It's set on the ground. It's set in prehistoric times. It's set among some nameless cavemen and cavewomen. Doesn't tell you who they are, doesn't tell you anything about their background. They go around doing monkey-like stuff. It's implied that one of them is the first ever prehistoric human to discover using a tool. They show them using a tool, and then they throw the tool up into the air. And then the tool goes up into space and then it morphs into some sort of space probe or something, skipping over millions of years of history, and they're going straight to the space thing. It's very, very lazy. Very lazy. You think of all the attempts that have been made to write a history of civilization. It's a very hard thing to do, but none of them have been so lazy that they skip straight from cavemen to the far future in space. No. Movies are for children. Don't watch movies. Anyway, if you're listening to this around a campfire, have a look up into the sky for a minute. Now, I know you can't necessarily see the sky when it's dark. The sky is invisible at night. It's all blackened out. I know you campers love to say, oh, we're out in the wide open without the light pollution that you usually get in civilization. You love to call it light pollution. That light pollution that you talk about, street lights and lit up shop fronts and cars. That's what helps me to go out in the dark. I can't go out in the dark if there's no street lights. But no, you go, oh, that's pollution. Would you go up to someone in a wheelchair and say, that wheelchair is belching out fumes. It's wearing down the concrete on the ground and it's using tires that are probably made from fish eggs. No, you would not. Oh no, you're happy to tell me that light lights up the metropolitan areas and makes it possible for me to go down to the bus stop at 6 o'clock in the morning when I need to and just about find it. You think, no, that's light pollution. Light pollution, that's what you say. That's ignorant. You're an ignoramus. But you're welcome to go and enjoy your light pollution free camping in some godforsaken hellhole in some forest or wherever it is. Have a look up at the sky. Look at your big fancy stars. So-called stars. Those are all suns, you know. Every sun that you're seeing in the night sky is causing light pollution in its own individual solar system. It's just not causing light pollution here. You probably hate our sun, do you? You think that's causing light pollution? It blanks out the view of the night sky. We want to look at other suns, not ours. No, enjoy the sun you have. We have a sun of our own. It's less than 93 million miles away. And we get to use that all day. We get a lot of benefits from that sun. You want the sun to go away so you can go and look at other system suns that are at least 20 billion miles away. You want to admire those instead. What in the name of Christ is wrong with you? You've no idea how lucky you have. Enjoy the sun you have. And don't be teaching our children to hate our own sun. That's not fair. They have to grow up with that sun. Someday that sun is going to start dying. They're going to have to feel attached to that sun and positive about it. Because some of those kids will have to volunteer to become the astronauts who fly to the sun and save it when the sun is dying out. And because of you, they're going to be cynical about it. They're going to say, oh, that sun is shit. Other stars are much better. Let it die. And that'll be your fault as a scout leader, so-called leader. What are you a leader of? You're a leader of a load of children in neckerchiefs and walking shoes. My experience of the scouts was very limited, as I say. I was in the Beavers, which is a very, very junior segment of the scouts for young children. You have the Beavers, and then you have the Cub Scouts, and then you have the Scouts proper. I was in the Beavers till I was 6 and a half. At the time, my brother was in the Cub Scouts, and my older brother was in the Scouts. So we had one at each level. We had proper representation of my family. Then we all moved house. We said, fuck it, fuck the Scouts. Enough of that. We're moving up to the suburbs. You don't need that anymore. You have cable television. Oh, no, we didn't get cable television until I was about 9. But we did have multi-channel. When I was 6 and a half, we moved from this place where we had 2 channels to this place where we had 6 channels. It was great. It was all through an aerial. We had the 2 Irish channels, then we had the 4 British channels. And then on one of the British channels, when there was a slight variation in programming once a week, and you wanted to see the stuff that was on the other variation, my father would retune the ITV channel from the Northern Ireland region to the Wales region to watch some sitcom, probably, that my mother wanted to watch on TV. That was great. So that was multi-channel. And then we moved to a place where we had cable television. That was great. We had 11 and a half channels or something like that. Now you want to go sit out in the field somewhere with your scouts and look at the moon. You probably think the moon is light pollution as well, do you? And go, Christ, the moon is in the way tonight. We can't see the stars. That's like looking at your spouse and saying, will you get out of the way? I'm trying to see the neighbour's spouse. You're blocking the view. No, it's just rude. Don't do that. Don't do that. Once upon a time, there was a dog, basically a dog. And this dog, he was sitting outside his owner's house one day, minding his own business, chewing a bone. Not giving any thought to where this bone came from, despite the fact that he's a dog who has no knowledge of the retail system or food distribution grid. It never occurs to him to wonder, why does my owner have bones? What or where is he getting them from? How long does he have to wait for the stuff around the bones to rot before he gives me the bone? Why does he give me the meat that's attached to the bone? Presumably was at one point. Is my owner a serial killer? No, doesn't even think about this. And that's the sort of animal you want as a guard dog, is it? You can just hand them a piece of a skeleton and they don't even wonder where does this come from. No, they play with it and they chew it, or they... I don't know, do dogs actually bury bones, or is that just a thing from the cartoons and comics? Perhaps they do, perhaps they bury bones. And perhaps when they do bury the bones, it's because they know somewhere deep in the back of their mind that this bone belongs under the ground. Problem with that is they come back and dig it up later. If you have bones in your house of any kind, You should be required to have some sort of certification that comes with the bone wherever you bought it, to certifying where this bone came from. Certifying that it came from a legitimate meat plant. It's not from some serial killer, such as, for example, you. Even worse, feeding them to their dogs or letting their dogs have them as toys. That needs to be checked up. Now, I don't mean lock everyone up as soon as you find them giving the bone to their dog. No, just have it certified. When you buy beef in this country, it's all traceable back to the exact herd owner that it was bought from. But no, you get a bone, no one cares where it came from. You have a bone, it's just, oh, I'm sure it came from the bone factory. The bone factory down the road. But no, no one cares. You can just own a bone and give it to your dog. Nobody gives a shit. To make it even more complicated, they sell plastic and rubber toy bones that you give to your dog. Be giving them a real bone and just tell everyone, no, no, that's not a real bone. It was taken out of a plastic skeleton that was originally manufactured for use in medical schools. There was a surplus, so they were sent to a discount store that now sells them as dog toys. Except they're not sold to dogs, because that's another problem with the system. Dogs don't partake in the retail system, so they have to be sold to their owners. I suppose that's reasonable. Oh no, if you're giving bones to your dog, you should be able to say where that bone came from. And it's not good enough to say, as far as I know, it's from a legitimate source. No, that's a cop-out. You could be inadvertently, through your lack of attention, you could be helping a serial killer get rid of their bones. And you don't give a shit. You don't give a shit. You just buy this thing. You probably got it down the local discount store or the supermarket in the dog section. And it just says dog bone. These things are hiding in plain sight. It says dog bone. And you just think, oh no, that's fine. It's a fake plastic bone for my dog. Or else you go to the dog food section in your supermarket and you get a bone. That's very good for your dog's teeth. Teeth are pretty much the mouthful equivalent of bones. You break a tooth, it hurts almost as much as breaking a bone. I've never broken a bone as far as I know. Unless perhaps I've broken a toe or something and not noticed. Can you break a toe and not notice? I'd say you probably can. I bang my knuckles against things all the time. Each bone in each of my fingers is probably broken into 8 little bones at this stage. I'm evolving into something. But that's fine. I can go to bed at night confident that I haven't given my cats a bone that could have come from another cat. My wife's mainly responsible for the cat toys and the cat treats. So anyway, his dog, he's sitting there outside his owner's house, minding his own business, playing with this bone. Well, licking the bone. Does that count as playing? I don't know. What is play for a dog? Because if a dog is licking a bone, maybe it thinks of that as playing. It's not doing it for any nutritional value. It's not hungry. It's not doing it for the taste. Like the way kids have a doll's tea party or something, and you pour out these fake plastic cups and saucers and teapots and you pretend to have a meal. Maybe dogs do that too. The dog is playing at licking a bone. But you give her a real bone that could have come from anywhere. You've made your dog an accomplice in some terrible crime. Now you might say, what if it's a crime of passion? Well, that's nonsense. Let's break that down a bit. A dog involved in a crime. There's no such thing as a dog crime. There are things that a dog can be put on death row for. But a dog isn't convicted of a crime, you know. That's not how it works. Dogs are not convicted of crimes. The nearest they get to being convicted of crimes is being declared to be so dangerous that they need to be put down. They've eaten a child or something, which is terrible. Doesn't mean the dog's a criminal. No, that's not how that works. Or at least I assume that's not how it works. Surely they don't have a judge ask the dog to stand up with its lawyer in court and say, you've been found guilty of this killing thing. You ate that child. Does the judge put on a black hat or something and say, you'll be taken from this place to another place, a high security kennel, and then you'll have a few chances to appeal, and then someone fellow will come along with a needle. He'll stab you with the needle, but that won't be your execution. That'll just be another dog who's there because he's a meth dealer. Not a very successful meth dealer. If he just gives out his wares for free to other dogs who he meets in prison. No. That's not a meth dealer. Even if dogs were meth dealers, surely they wouldn't just go up to another dog who's just arrived on death row. Wait a minute, though. I haven't thought that through. We all know drug dealers do this thing where they give you it for free first and then they get you hooked. A dishonest meth dealing dog, I assume they're dishonest because they're in dog prison. But of course, go up to another dog and stab it with the injection and get it addicted and then start the whole sales thing. Say, dog, did you enjoy that, dog? And the dog will say, yes, I enjoyed that very much, thank you. I've had a very stressful day. I've just come out of court where I was convicted of capital murder. And my solicitor says, don't worry, this isn't the end of the road. We have plenty of appeals processes to go through. But still, no, I've been very stressed. But whatever you've just done to my arm there, it's helped enormously. It's relieved the tension. It's like getting a massage. It's like getting a chemical massage. I presume it's chemicals you've got in there, is it? Or wait, it's a blood transfusion. A blood transfusion would make you feel uplifted as well. And of course, the other dog will go then. Oh, yes, that's right. It's a blood transfusion. And if you'd like any more blood transfusions, I can get them for you. No problem. No problem at all. Just say the word or wink at me. Do dogs wink? I don't know. Our cats wink sometimes. I don't know if dogs wink. Are they sophisticated enough to wink? Or are they so sophisticated that they blink instead? They're able to wink with both eyes simultaneously and have it all match up. That's an amazing feat for any being. Both eyes at the same time. A double wink. I think that's quite a feat. Lately I've been watching stuff on TikTok. Some of the videos, the audio is out of sync with the video. And that's using the latest advanced internet technology. These massive, massive, massive video servers. And they can't get the video to line up with the audio. So imagine how much more difficult it is for the eyes to do that. Two eyes. They don't even have you consciously controlling it. It's all done subconsciously. And you're able to blink both eyes at the same time. Isn't that great? When you start thinking about it, that's when it's a problem. You start blinking now and think about your blinking as you're doing it. Think, is my left eye and my right eye, are they blinking in unison or is one slightly later than the other? You get yourself into an awful mess thinking about that. That's when you get all up in your head. You have to get out of your head. Get down out of your head. Take some deep breaths. Visualize yourself coming down out of your brain, down through the bottom of your skull, back down your neck hole and back into your chest and down into your stomach. And you're out of your head then. You don't want to know what's going on in your head unless it's conscious. So leave the subconscious stuff alone. It can take care of itself. It's perfectly fine. We worry too much about our subconscious minds, about what they get up to. We go, oh, I wonder did my subconscious mind go on a killing spree last night while I was asleep. Well, maybe it did, maybe it didn't. The police can sort that out. I'm sure if he did go on a killing spree, you'll get a notification at some point. Unless they only arrest your subconscious self. Actually, that might be a way to handle it. If your subconscious self is going around sleepwalking and killing people at night, perhaps a way for the judiciary system and the police to deal with that would be to arrest your subconscious self, do the interviews with your subconscious self while you're asleep. But then before you wake up every morning to get out of your house, you wake up and it's back to normal. You've no idea that went on. So your conscious self doesn't get involved at all. You could have an honest interview with an honest assessment of your subconscious self and get to the bottom of this while you're asleep and you won't be all up in your head. That's not to say that your subconscious is not going to lie through its teeth. No. For a few nights, the police will come back every night while you're asleep and interview your subconscious self. You'll have a night court of some kind. I presume they'll do it remotely. They'll bring in a video camera. You'll appear by video link in front of a night court, all asleep. The main advantage of this, if it turns out that you're not guilty, your conscious self will never have been through the stress of this trial and interrogation. As we all know, if someone's not guilty, we want them to go through as little stress as possible, have swift justice and have them cleared as quickly as possible with as little stress as possible so your subconscious can do all the defending itself and appearing in court and all that and your conscious self doesn't need to hear anything about it. At the end of the trial, when you're cleared, you'll get a letter in the post saying, yeah, hello, just to let you know, congratulations, your subconscious self was on trial for the last few weeks. Every night we came into your home and we had a warrant. Don't worry, we had a warrant to do this. And we put you on video link to the local night court. I don't know why it had to be in local night court. If it's video link, it could be anywhere. Maybe it was anywhere, I don't know. If they're doing this a lot, I presume they'd have a centralised night court. I don't know. They'll say in the letter, "We're required by law to tell you that we put you on trial and cleared you of this terrible crime. Now, if your conscious self has any information that might lead to the capture of the real killer, please let us know. In fact, you're required to let us know now. We're going to give you a week to think about this, because you're only just finding out about this now. So we'll give you a week to think about all this. It's not to get your story straight, no. If you have any information that might lead to the arrest of whoever did this, that would be great. And it's pretty much your duty, your civic duty as a citizen of this land, this great land in which you live." You Americans had a sitcom about a night court. I think it was called Night Court. I remember watching it in the late 90s or early 2000s when it was on here. They showed it at night. I think the television station thought, "Oh, these Americans, they sold us this old sitcom called Night Court. I think we can only show that at night." They showed it at either 12:30 or 1:30 at night. They showed Night Court followed by or preceded by something called Barney Miller.
Into your head.
I've never been to court of any kind, and I hope I never will be, and I hope I never have to work in a court either, because they sound like hellish places. For one thing, if you're in a night court, does that mean you're on 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. or something? Or maybe do night courts just happen in the evening and they just call it night court because it's kind of after hours, but not really. It's from 6 p.m. to 10 or something. I didn't pay enough attention to the sitcom Night Court. I remember as a child, the first time I heard about going to college at night, going to night school, I thought they're going for their jobs or whatever they do during the day. Then they're going home for dinner, watching a bit of television. And maybe about 10 p.m. they head off to school and they stay there all night till 6 a.m. Almost like a boarding school, because in a boarding school you stay there all night too. But in the boarding school, you're not going to classes all night. No, you do your classes during the day, and then at night you do other stuff. You live in the school, but not at night school. Unless perhaps in the night school, you're doing your classes all night, and then during the daytime, you get to go to bed. That would be an efficient way to do it. Now did you mention it? Running a boarding school, you should have night school and day school. And then each dormitory could have double occupancy, and never the twain shall meet. You might think, I don't want my child going to some school where he has to share his bed, even if it's not at the same time, but he has to take shifts with his bed. That's ridiculous. I suppose it is. It's just a thing on the podcast. So you don't need to have your knickers in a twist over it. It's not actually going to happen in real life. Relax. I'm not planning to set up some boarding school that works like that. I'm not qualified to set up a school of any kind, not least a boarding school. I assume if you're running a boarding school, on top of all the educational qualifications, you probably have to be certified as a hosteliery or a hotelier or the accommodation industry. If you run an approved bed and breakfast place, they send an agency round to check out what your sausages are like that you give for breakfast in the morning. They check out what kind of setup you've got with the bedrooms. Are you putting everyone in the cupboard under the stairs like Harry Potter, or do you have proper bedrooms? So I presume it's the same for one of these boarding schools. When I was a child, I used to go to a library, and the librarian noticed I was taking out these Billy Bunter novels about a very old-fashioned English boarding school. Billy Bunter had very old-fashioned teachers who went round wearing cloaks. He's always pilfering food or getting into trouble. Turned out the librarian had his own personal collection of Billy Bunter annuals. Billy Bunter stories from the original so-called comics. They weren't comics at all. They were written stories, like something you'd expect Charles Dickens would put in the 17th century version of Playboy magazine. It wasn't a proper comic at all. One or two illustrations in it. The typed story on faded print. Written in three or four columns like a newspaper, but in a book. Absolutely fucking ridiculous. No wonder my eyes don't work anymore. trying to read that shit when I was 10 or 11. Anyway, for some reason, this librarian, he had his stash of Billy Bunter books that he kept in the library, and he targeted kids. If he saw some kid reading the modern Billy Bunter novel that was officially part of the library, he'd come out and say, "Oh, do you want to borrow this?" And he didn't even have to stamp it. It wasn't an official loan. It was a personal loan from him, which I found rather awkward. I don't want to be lent personal stuff by the librarian. No. If you want to set up your own personal library, there's people who have these little libraries at their front gate, and you put a load of their books in there, and you're supposed to take one out and borrow it or swap it or something. People on social media are always going on about how cute they are. Little mini lending library or book swap or whatever it is. You're at this book thing at someone's front gate, or a passerby walking your dog or something. Someone who'll do that, they're well-meaning, not up to anything. People who do that, they want to share their love of reading, and that's all very fine. But you know damn well that while you're browsing that mini library at their front gate, the little cabinet there, they're going to be watching you out a window somewhere through a crack in the curtain. This is their hobby. They want to watch you doing it. They want to get some enjoyment out of it. And I'm sure I would do the same if I was them. Just be aware, those people will be doing that, so just don't pick your nose or anything. I suppose that's the offline equivalent of having a podcast, really, isn't it? Well, except they don't write the books themselves, do they? Or maybe they do. Are there less successful authors or authors who don't feel the need to make money? Do they put their books on loan in a mini library at the front gate? Maybe they do. And then they watch and say, "Oh, someone took one of my books." Isn't that great? They don't put any forewords or introductions in their book. Instead, they put an afterword after the epilogue that says, "By the way, I saw you taking this book out of the thing. Well done." Oh, don't worry, I didn't photograph you. Well, I kind of did. I took a temporary photo of you, like snapshot or one of those things. I took a temporary photo. I only took the photo and kept for long enough so that I could draw a sketch of you, because that's my other hobby. I like drawing sketches of people, like what police artists do, except I do it with people who have already been caught. You've already been caught using my lending library. I don't mean you've done anything wrong, no. We've already done it. So I'm drawing a police sketch of you. I throw away the photograph then. I've drawn the sketch from, because I don't want to be weird about it. So I have sketches of you all over my kitchen. Not my main kitchen, because people see that. I have a second kitchen upstairs. Really a kitchenette. It's in the corner of my bedroom. I have a microwave there that I mainly use for heating up milk and popcorn, microwave popcorn. We had a phase years ago where we used to have a lot of microwave popcorn. It's a very delicate procedure, I can tell you. You get these things. We used to get them in little, these popcorns in a big paper bag that you unfold. You have to make sure to position it properly in the microwave. And then you listen. It starts popping. Just as the pops are starting to fade, you have to figure out the exact time to stop it. And if you're a few pops too late, then everything's burnt to a crisp. If you're a few pops too early, then you have unpopped kernels in amongst your popcorn, and then you've no teeth left. Or else they do put them in their main kitchen for two possible reasons. One, they don't mind people seeing these. They don't think there's anything weird about it. Or two, nobody ever comes into their house. And that could be a good thing or a bad thing, as it means, one, they're not bringing people into their house. There's not going to be any victims of any horrific thing happening to them indoors. So at least when they're doing their weird photographing of you, you're outdoors in clear public sight. So that's one possible reason. The other possible reason is that nobody wants to visit them. Well, beggars can't be choosers. That's the thing with these libraries. The same is true of that Billy Bunter thing. He was giving me a free loan of his personal property. These massive hardback annuals took about 3 years to read them. And then I'd bring them back. As a shy child, I'd bring them back to the check-in counter in the library. And they'd say, "Oh, these aren't part of the library. These were given to you on personal loan from your man." But to make a song and dance about it. That library, I remember, very strange setup. You go in one door, and then you go in the other door, and then on the left would be the kind of a stage. It looked like a kind of a stage to me. And it's only just occurred to me that maybe it was used as a stage in the evenings or something. Maybe there were people giving poetry recitals, the infant's book section. It was up a couple of steps on a kind of stage thing with rails around it. That's always not very strange now that I think about it. In fact, when I said there was something strange about that library, I wasn't even thinking there was something strange. I was just hoping I'd say something that would be strange. But no, there's nothing strange about the library. Other than that fucking weirdo who keeps Billy Bunter books stashed in the bag and pounces on any child who has the temerity to rent a modern Billy Bunter novel and says, oh, you might be interested in these. Well, yes, I might, but if it involves interaction, needless additional interaction with any adult, it'd be not worth it to me. This was in the 1980s. I'm sure libraries are much more pleasant now than they were then. You probably go in with a smart card, pop your books into some letterbox, and then when you're renting them, I presume. I haven't been to a library since the early 1990s. Everything involved going up to this checkout. You choose your books, you ring them up. The fellow would open up the inside back cover. There's a little paper pocket on the inside back cover, and there's a little kind of card in there, and he takes the card out and he puts it inside your ticket. Your ticket is kind of based on a kangaroo design. Doesn't look anything like a kangaroo, but a card with a pocket in it. He takes your ticket, he puts the ticket representing that book and puts it into the ticket, and then he files it somewhere until you bring the book back. And that's why I brought that up. There was this fella who used to do that, and he'd be leaning over. He was very short-sighted, I presume. I was not yet vision impaired at the time, so I didn't think it was... I didn't think anything very much other than it looked gross what he was doing. He had a very long fringe, and he'd lean over these books and these filing drawers. He'd be looking for your ticket, and he'd be leaning over this long greasy hair hanging over as he leaned over very close to this ticket thing. Gross and disgusting. And I just remembered. I say I haven't been to a library since then. What am I talking about? I worked in a library in the 2000s. It wasn't a public library, it was a library of a government department, but nonetheless, I worked in a library. A library that lent books to staff and bought them periodicals and all sorts of shit. I worked in an actual library. And here I am saying I haven't been to a library since the early 90s. You wouldn't have got any Billy Bunter books in there, I can tell you, from the one I worked in. No. Assume the modern library, the modern public lending library. You go in, you pick your books, and then you go up to some machine, and I presume you probably take out your smartphone now, do you? You have to scan it on some QR code, and then say, that's great, off you go, and then you don't interact with any other human beings. I think I'd like that very much. Only problem is I can't read anymore, which isn't a problem, because I get audio books. I'm not going to go down to some building somewhere to get all your books, though, no. That'd be like going down to the post office to collect your email. If you're listening to this from the back seat of a horse, I should probably clarify that. Well, I don't know if I can. It hasn't been clarified to me yet. I don't know what a back seat of a horse is. Is there a possibility you can have a double saddle on a horse, like on a motorbike? When you have a passenger, you can have someone on the front operating the horse and then just have a passenger on the back of the horse on a second saddle, or maybe on the same saddle, but it's just longer. Is that possible? Do you have to arrange yourself to make sure you're not seated on one of the ribs, if that's the case? Because that would be uncomfortable. Do you sit on its ribs or between its ribs? Which is the most ideal? I don't know. But I imagine if you manage to see on a point where you're between two of the horse's ribs, you're kind of settling down between them, your weight is kind of... I know you probably take up more space than the width between two ribs on a horse, but if most of your weight is dipping down in between the two ribs, that would push the horse's ribs apart, wouldn't it? You wouldn't want that. Unless you're preparing the horse for open heart surgery, I suppose. They might need to move the ribs apart and get in there between the ribs to operate on its internal organs. You would do that surely through its chest, not its back, would you? Maybe not. I don't know how you operate on a horse. Back in the old days, before heart surgery and internal surgery was all done through a telescope, you put a little cable in and it travels up to their blood vessels or something. You do it all like that. I know, if you're doing open heart surgery or something in its chest or something like that, would you go in from the back or the front in a horse? I and a person, you'd go in through the front. What would be more comfortable for the horse? Now, obviously, during surgery, it'll be comfortable because it's under anaesthetic. But when it wakes up and it's recovering, it needs to be able to lie down in a comfortable position. What's the most comfortable way for a horse to sleep? I doubt it sleeps on its back, does it? I don't think so. So perhaps the optimal location to enter a horse for the purposes of chest surgery would be through its back rather than through its chest. Does it even have a chest? The undersurface of the horse. Do you call it a floor? I don't know. Inside of it would be the floor. But wait a minute. What do you call the underside of a horse? Because let's say you're talking about a building. You have floors and ceilings. And if you're talking about the floor up above you, from your point of view, that's a ceiling. But from the point of view of that room above you, that's its floor. The underside of the horse for the belly and the chest would be, if you think of that as the floor, then you're being inaccurate. Well, the inside of that is the floor of the dog's inside. Now, the horse. Now, the horse is quite large. The inside of the horse's torso is quite a spacious place. It has a floor, effectively, not as level or stable as a normal floor of a building, but it has somewhat of a floor. But we're talking about the outside of that, where the belly and the chest are on the underside of the horse. Would you call that a floor? I don't think you would, but you also wouldn't call it a ceiling unless you're using that horse as, I don't know, as part of a building. Maybe when you're traveling with horses in some situation, you have a tent and you put the tent under the horse and use the horse as a kind of roof, a ceiling. That would be a ceiling then as well. A lot of caravans and mobile homes and RVs, as you Americans call them, they have an extra pull-out tent compartment that you pull out and it makes an extra little room that comes out when you're parked. So it wouldn't be out of the question for a horse to have a tent attached to its saddle that you unfold as a convenient tent, just in case of emergencies for the people there. And presumably the tent would also have a part that you fold up around the horse. The tent has an upstairs on it that covers the horse. The horse will be in the upstairs. His legs will be in the downstairs of the tent, holding everything up. The horse, of course, will have to stay standing all night. And maybe you put in supports for the underside of the horse then, like you would in a tent. You put supports on the tent to keep its shape. So maybe you'd have handy supports you put under the horse. So he can just relax, put his weight on those supports instead of its legs. Well, you're going to carry all that equipment, which you might as well just bring a cart behind the horse to have a proper covered caravan. I suppose. Oh, we're getting the horse and nothing me now. 2 weeks ago, I announced that I was temporarily going to not do my regular segment that starts with Once Upon a Time There Was a Dog. Because I had found that I was so often inadvertently getting onto the topic of dog anatomy and I was getting a bit much. So then the week before last, I instituted the ban for one episode and it was successful. So went back to the dog segment last week and it was problem free. We didn't get onto dog anatomy at all. But now here I am this week and I'm going on to horse anatomy. It's not even the dog segment. I've already recorded the dog segment for this episode. This isn't even part of that. I don't even have the excuse that I got onto horse anatomy from the dog thing, because I'm always saying it's so easy to absentmindedly get on from the subject of dogs to dog anatomy. Well, no, I just got onto horse anatomy of my own accord. It's not really horse anatomy, though, is it? No, I'm talking about the inside of the horse being a floor. If you go to any veterinary surgical lecture and they're telling you about anatomy of a horse, you won't hear them talking about a floor of a horse or the ceiling. It just sounds sophisticated because they're in Latin. And if you actually know Latin, they probably sound just like swear words or something. These intellectuals can trick you by bamboozling you with Latin. They used to do this in mass. There used to be a lot of masses done in Latin. And they say, no, it has to be done in Latin. We can't have people understanding this. There needs to be some distance between you and the supreme being. We're going to get in the way. We're going to say it all in Latin. We go, Dominus abigus stapi agraforbius hominus abi debigus. We never found out what they were saying in Latin. When I went to school, one of the teachers was obsessed for half a year with having us learn how to do a mass in Irish. He prepped for it for months. We learned all these hymns in Irish. We learned all these prayers in Irish. And we went to the church one day and we did the Mass in Irish. And nothing came of it. None of us grew up to become Irish language priests or anything. We learned nothing from this. Absolutely nothing. It was pointless. Absolutely pointless. If we can do it in English, do it in English. It's perfectly fine. You don't have to translate everything. It's a lovely language, this Irish. It is. We have this Irish language. The only problem is nobody understands what you're talking about. And now you get on the bus here. Occasionally, a considerate driver will switch on the automated announcements, which can be very useful nowadays. They'll say, oh, you're now approaching Bray. Well, now every announcement by law, you have to say it in English and Irish, which means people are twice as annoyed by these announcements. And therefore, the driver is twice as likely to switch them off. And then they're no use to anyone. That's how I ended up one day getting on the train that was going to Waterford. And I meant to get on the train to Port Leash. There wasn't an announcement in that instance. Signs on the train door said Port something or other. And I thought that was Port Leash. But it wasn't. It was Port Lauraga or something, which is Irish for Waterford. So I got on the wrong train, thanks to your Irish. I know Port Lauraga and Port Leash are different. They look very similar when they're very blurry. It's like something you'd hear on the radio. They're phoning in saying, hello, I'd like to talk about the Irish language on public transport. And the presenter will say, oh, that's great. You go on and say that and I'll interview you. I'm going to make you sound very important. And then we'll tweet about it. We'll say today on delete that bit. That's absolute tripe. While I'm here, I might as well use my instance of saying the word tripe to test my new pop filter. Tripe. 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 You'll probably never get to hear that. I'll probably edit that out. Tripe. Tripe. Populate. Philistine. Prentice. What's Prentice? Where am I getting that? Is that that woman on Criminal Minds? I think it might be. There's a woman on Criminal Minds called Prentice, I think is her name. And she rises to the top mainly because your man, what's his name, who was the boss in Criminal Minds for a very long time, was removed from the show quite suddenly. And she rose to the top. She became the head of the team. People find her very annoying. I have no opinion one way or the other, but I happen to know people who watch that show find her quite annoying. Some of them do. Some of them don't, and some of them do. Just remember, she's not real. Although now that I think of it, the fact that she's not real does not make it any better. Because the fact that this irritating character who's not real, this irritating woman, Prentice on Criminal Minds, the fact that she's not real, that makes it worse because it means someone has gone out of their way to create this unpleasant character just to annoy you. Someone whose whole job consists of creating characters that are compelling for you, created a character that's repellent to you. Why would you do that? You're bad at your job then. If you create a character in a long-running procedural drama, if you create a character that people don't want to see, you failed at your job. Don't be doing that. I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, wait a minute. Television drama has to have conflict. So there has to be unpleasant people or undesirable people. It can't be like Star Trek where everyone's all nice to each other. The crew never have any arguments about anything. Not until Gene Roddenberry dies anyway. Until Gene Roddenberry was near death, everyone on Star Trek, the rule was that they couldn't have any conflict between the characters. You could only have conflict with some hideous alien, like those fellows with the big ears who were obsessed with money. Or the Klingons. Is it Klingon or Klingon? I'm not sure. You don't have cling film in America. I think you call it saran wrap or something. So every time you see a Klingon, you don't think that sounds ridiculous. It sounds like tinfoil or something. It sounds like something you put around a plate of sandwiches. Not all the way around. But you don't put it around the bottom of the plate. You just put a bit of it on the edge of the bottom of the plate for the cling film to cling to. You don't put it around the whole plate. Although sometimes I do. Just for simplicity. Sometimes I can't be arsed trying to figure this out, stretching the cling film over the edge of the plate. It's just too much like work. Sometimes I just wrap it around like I'm at the end of the production line in that Christmas tree factory that I worked in the early 1990s for one summer. I get to the end of the line. Some of the older students who were there on a summer job are there in charge of this pallet wrap thing. They have this whole pile of Christmas trees is spun round or some turntable or something. And it just goes round and round and round with a huge roll of plastic wrap. Just wrap it around and around and around until it's wrapped so much it can't get wet or anything, and then you're done. That's what I do with plates sometimes. Over and under and over and under and over and under. It's like Fort Knox trying to get out of that. You have to remember to take it out before you put it in the microwave, and then when you forget to do that, don't put cling film in your dishwasher. Either intentionally or accidentally, it's not good. You don't want that in there. Spend half your next morning cleaning it up, wondering, why is this place full of plastic? Did all my plates melt? I thought they were china or something. Are they supposed to melt? I don't know. What temperature do plates melt at? What the hell kind of a question is that? Absolute nonsense. So yes, I did work at a Christmas tree factory. I'm sure I've spoken about this before. The big highlight of my student life for about a month. Artificial Christmas trees. And it was in July. They packed artificial Christmas trees, putting bits of Christmas trees into boxes. They don't even assemble them. They throw a load of Christmas tree parts into a box, seal them up and send them off somewhere to be sold. Absolutely ridiculous now that I think about it. What's ridiculous about it though? There's demand for artificial Christmas trees, including in our house. We had artificial Christmas trees my entire childhood. We had artificial Christmas trees. In fact, for a long time, we had a sawn-off artificial Christmas tree because full-size artificial Christmas tree was a bit much. It's indoors. You don't need a full-size tree in a house. No, it's ornamental. You get a thing that can fit on a side table, put some nice lights on it, bit of tinsel on the ceilings, and you're done. No need for it. You actually want a full-size meadow instead of a carpet in your sitting room. No, you don't want a full-size artificial meadow in your sitting room. Impossible to keep clean. Can you imagine? A carpet is an artificial indoor lawn, and that's easy enough to keep clean. A meadow, a very, very deep-treaded carpet, effectively. An artificial meadow with artificial flowers. My cats would have that destroyed in 2 days. No. An artificial meadow would be quite nice if you could find some way around the maintenance. 6-inch deep carpet, like grass, but soft woody grass. Not stupid, disgusting outdoor grass that your dog pisses on. No, soft artificial flowers made of fabric. Nice soft stuff that you can sink your feet into. Maybe an artificial sun overhead. That could be nice. Of course, the television would break the fantasy, but that's okay. Put something nice on the television as well. Put on Teletubbies, that's what they do. There's this show for young children, a British programme called Teletubbies. It's about, it's not really about anything. The setting looks like a Windows 98 wallpaper, very green, manicured grass and blue sky and perfect grassy hills. Looks very nice. That could look very pleasant in a sitting room. So it's just have the meadow around the park where you usually have a rug, maybe in front of the fireplace. As long as it's not a fire risk, I suppose. Which is not going to be. Nobody lights fires. Nobody lights fires. The last 25 years in this country, not one person has lit a fire in their fireplace intentionally. They have not. The only reason for having a chimney on a house now is to have something to tell your children every December. Like something magical that happens. But if you're prepared to tell them about that, to make up that fantasy, why don't you just make up the thing about the chimney as well instead of actually building one? You don't need to build a chimney just for that. Draw a fireplace and maybe as part of your Christmas decorations, put a, I was going to say an artificial chimney, that's a meaningless term. But no, put a temporary cardboard chimney on top of the house. They're not going to go up there and look at it, so it'll look fine from the ground. You put an artificial chimney on top of your house, maybe on top of the gable wall or something. People put lighting and decorations on their roofs sometimes. There's always one person in every state who does a huge set of decorations on top of their roof. A cardboard chimney on the top of the side gable wall, tell your kids that's where Santa comes down. And then in the sitting room, install a picture of a fireplace, a very realistic painting of a fireplace. Just like those things you see some places. Some places they'll have an artist, some pedestrian street. They'll do a painting, a mural on the road that looks like a huge hole. It looks very realistic. It looks like there's a big hole like the street. So if you can do that, you can do the same drawing a fireplace on the wall of your sitting room. Do the fireplace up high near the ceiling so your children can't get near it because it looks more realistic from far back. And they're going to want to know, why is the fireplace up so high? And you'll say, obviously, it's for safety, you moron. It's for safety. We have children. We don't have a fireplace. Why at the level where children are crawling around on the floor? And also, we have an artificial meadow for a carpet. And that's a fire hazard. We don't want sparks coming out of that into the meadow. And we won't be lighting a fire either. So I suppose the meadow thing doesn't really matter. Because if you do light a fire in that, they're going to freak. If you tell a child you've installed this fireplace in this chimney for Santa Claus to come down and then you light a fire in it, that's going to ruin it for you. So just be careful what you say there. I'm not a parent, so I know you parents are very, very busy all the time. You don't have time to think about things like this. I have time to think about these things. So let me warn you now, I've had time to think about this. Don't light a fire in a chimney at Christmas if you have children. You'll freak them out. Unless you want to combine Christmas with April Fool's Day. Maybe if you're in the Southern Hemisphere. Does Christmas fall around April Fool's Day in the Southern Hemisphere? Maybe it does. And you want to tell your kids, oh, Santa Claus couldn't come last night. There was a problem with the fireplace. And then have a pile of ashes on the floor. So, no, don't do that. That's a bit dark. Don't do that. Don't do that. Not unless your children are all grown up. If they're 27 or something and still living with you, be a lesson to them for expecting presents when they're fully grown adults. That would be a good reason to keep the magic of Santa going until they're 27. Are you going into your head? Two cats walk into a bar. One of the cats says hello. And I've a packer of your finest artificial chocolate cigarettes, please. And the man behind the bar says, oh, we don't sell those in here, sir. This is a bar for adults. We don't sell artificial sweet cigarettes. Those are for children. And also, it's not really the done thing to buy toy cigarettes for children anymore. It's considered that it sets a bad example. Because these children, they get these toy cigarettes that are just made of chocolate or sugar and stuff that you eat. Do I need to explain to you what happens with that? They get addicted to eating cigarettes. And then when they grow up, they can't find any edible cigarettes anymore. Because, well, they've kind of gone out of fashion. It's not really the done thing to sell them anymore. Even to children. You go around as an adult trying to find sweet chocolate cigarettes or sweet cigarettes, play cigarettes. They're basically just sugar with a bit of red colouring on the end. You can't find them. So they end up having to get actual tobacco cigarettes, and they're not really edible. I mean, I know there are people who chew on tobacco. Is that healthy? I don't know. I can't imagine that it is. Is it healthier than chewing gum? I don't know. Chewing gum is full of sugar, I imagine. Well, unless you get sugar-free chewing gum, I suppose. They have sugar-free chewing gum. They put sweeteners in that. They put the same stuff in that, do they, as they put in Diet Coca-Cola. Do you remember that green Coke they had a few years ago? There was a thing called Coke Life, and that had another new, very fashionable artificial sweetener. That seems to have disappeared now. That's the first time in my living memory that a variation of Coca-Cola has been taken off the market. That's a massive step back for civilization. This Coca-Cola has been around since the 1700s or something. You used to get it in glass bottles back in the era of cowboys and whatever they had over here during the cowboy era. We didn't have cowboys. We didn't have a Wild West. We had a West and we had people living in the West. Well, the ones who weren't dying from the famine or having to emigrate to get away from the famine. Half of them died in the potato famine. The other half emigrated to New York and ended up being played in some fucking movie where they're all criminals. What's that one with Daniel Day-Lewis in the mustache? I've never watched it. It looks annoying to me. Much as I enjoy some of the Martin Scorsese movies, I'm never going to watch that. It looks annoying. It looks almost as annoying as those episodes of Star Trek The Next Generation where they have Space Irish in Holosuite. No, I skipped those episodes. And the Irish people on Star Trek, except the one played by Colm Meaney. He's the acceptable face of Irish people in Star Trek. I can recommend him. He's realistic. He's like any Dublin father you'd meet in the streets today. I approve of that. For any other Irish people you see on Star Trek from the 80s or 90s, you might as well just put a leprechaun in it. They come around to your door wearing a hat and they say, "Hello, I'm a leprechaun. I'm going to take over your house. Please move now." I don't mean move out, just move aside so I can come in. And you say, "No, I'm sorry. You can't take over my house. You don't exist. You're a figment of my imagination. I've just drunk half a bottle of Putsheen." And the leprechaun will say, "You have to explain that for the foreigners listening to this. What the fuck is Putsheen?" And you say, "It's a bit like moonshine." Whatever that alcohol is that's basically 103% alcohol. You don't want a beverage that makes you hallucinate very, very, very racial stereotypes of your own people. No, that's ridiculous. Back in the 1980s, they used to have an ad with cartoon black and white minstrels on it. You collect these things called minstrels, which were a coupon you cut off of your box of tea leaves, and you collect them up to enter some competition. You'd be watching the TV news. You'd have a commercial break. Cartoon minstrels in vertical striped blazers and hats singing tea songs. They go, "Extra quality, extra flavour. Nine's the quality tea." It was absolutely appalling. Don't really realise it was appalling. That went on for years and years. Never occurred to anyone that it was appalling until around 1988. And then someone said, "This is appalling." I think you started having radio phone-ins then, and people started saying, "This is appalling. Go away. Get rid of this." And then someone said, "I agree, that's appalling. And have you seen this book called Noddy? It's also a cartoon on the television that your children are watching." I don't know if you have Enid Blyton on other continents, but Enid Blyton was a children's author. She was the Famous Five and the Secret Seven. And this thing called Noddy, little fella going around in a red hat, and he had a friend. It was called the Gollywog or something like that. I think it was written 80 or 90 years ago or something. I used to watch that as a young child, and then at some point someone said, "Wait, Noddy, that's still a thing. Why is that on the television? What in the name of Christ?" And then someone else said, "Excuse me, do not take our Lord's name in vain. Do not take our Lord's name in vain." Now you say, "I didn't take it in vain. I just said, Jesus Christ, I wasn't injecting it into my veins." And he'll say, "No, that's not what I meant." And you'll say, "How would you know what you meant? You don't know what you're talking about. You're barely an established character on a nonsense discussion on a podcast. I can't even remember who you're supposed to be now. Oh, you're some fellow objecting to me taking the Lord's name in vain because it went Jesus Christ in response to the Gollywog on the Noddy Show." Well, that sounds right, does it? I think so. The world over here changed very quickly during the 1990s. We got rid of all these black and white minstrels on the Nines TV. And then I think the Gollywogs, well, that wasn't an Irish production. That would have been on English television. So that was their problem. I think that went away at some point. People decided it was offensive. And then other people said, "You're being politically correct," or something. The old word for woke is say politically correct. And they invented the word woke. But by the time they invented the word woke, all that stuff had gone away. The Gollywogs thing, black and white minstrels TV ad. I think was there a prize draw or something. It was like the prize bonds, except you cut bits off your tea packet. And the thing with these, I always found, collecting coupons or soft things, these products come in cardboard boxes that have been designed by presumably a cardboard architect or designer in some packaging architect's office somewhere. He's gone to the trouble of creating this packaging, especially cereal boxes. Someone created those cereal boxes, designed them very carefully to be able to protect the integrity of a bag of very delicate cereal that's being carted halfway around the world on a ship and put on a lorry and delivered everywhere and brought home in your shopping bag. And then you're supposed to cut a square out of these boxes every time there's some competition that you send in a token for. Surely that loses all structural integrity when you do that. You don't want to be cutting a hole in the box. I'm drinking not tap water, but it tastes like tap water. A particularly old bottle of sparkling Tesco own brand spring water that's basically given up on life. Its fizz is long gone. I think I opened this bottle about a week ago and forgot about it. I don't throw stuff out. I'm not going to waste water in a world where there's drought and starvation and there's plastic bottles getting into fish's mouths. You get very worried about putting plastic into fish's mouths because it's bad for them. You don't want to be putting plastic into your fishes. Well, what was my point going to be about that? I don't know, to be honest. Don't worry, I wasn't going to go on some tirade saying it's politically correct to want to protect the fishes. No, don't worry. I do wonder, though, how we're running out of fish. How we're so much running out of fish, having so many shortages of fish. We're worried about fish stock. When every person you know in the whole planet, every one of them will tell you they don't eat fish, they don't like fish, they find the taste of fish disgusting, and yet somehow we're running out of fish. We're draining the oceans of all our fishes by eating them all. I don't know anyone who's eating these fishes. Who's eating them? If you're eating the fishes, you must be eating an awful lot of them. You're eating enough for the rest of us. You're like one of those people who has 85 children. You've had enough children to cover for the rest of us who don't have them. In which case, well done. But you don't need to eat all our fishes as well. Or if you do, you have to take the blame for that. You're draining the oceans of fishes. Fishes are not a renewable resource. They don't fall from the sky like rain. Or do they? Wait a minute. Where do fishes come from? Surely they don't just reproduce, do they? How would a fish reproduce? It's just a blob. How can a blob just reproduce? I suppose it's one of the miracles of Mother Nature. Do fishes lay eggs? They probably do. Oh wait, caviar. Isn't that a fish egg thing? I think so. Or is that frog's leg? We weren't taught about caviar in school. Before we did nature classes in primary school, they always love to go on about frog spawn. They say, that's a frog, and that stuff there, that's a pool of baby tadpoles. They're going to turn into frogs. But then you have, what's that other thing that's like a frog but is different? Toad. Is a toad a different thing from a frog? Or is it just called a toad in cartoonish children's animations and books? Wait a minute. Well, that thing about a toad, was it The Wind in the Willows or something? Or was it a thing with a toad in it? And Paul McCartney wrote a song called The Frog Chorus. Well, was that for that thing with the toad in it? So had he just decided, I'm not going to call it a toad, I'm going to call it a frog, because I believe that's a frog. The writers of this thing think it's a toad, but I think it's a frog. You have the same issue with rabbits and hares. I used to watch Bugs Bunny as a child, and that was a rabbit. They teach you about rabbits in school, they teach you about frogs in school, but they don't teach you about toads and hares. They're the same issue with tennis and badminton. We all knew what tennis was, we didn't know what badminton was. We just knew it looked very similar. They had the same tools, the same implements. They presumably played them on the same type of courts, more or less. Rearranged the courts slightly when it's badminton. I don't know. Maybe they decide when they're doing these curriculums, they go through each thing we need to teach them about and just pick one of each type. So the rabbit hare bunny thing will pick rabbit, and that'll be a representative sample. And then out of the badminton, tennis, squash thing, we'll teach them tennis. And then out of the toad, frog thing, we'll say frog. You can't teach them everything. The best thing you can do is teach them how to find out stuff. Teach them how to use an encyclopedia. Teach them how to watch an educational television program. Teach them how to watch a movie. We were taught how to watch movies in school. We had one teacher who came in every week for religion, and he'd stand at the door of the classroom and wave a videotape. And that was the signal that we were to follow him up to the video room and spend half an hour there watching another installment of, oh, what's that movie? Mississippi Burning. That was a very serious movie. Too serious for me to describe on here on a frivolous. See, I can't even pronounce the word frivolous. So maybe I shouldn't be frivolous either. I can't be serious and talk about this very serious movie that we watched in religion class over the course of what seemed like 15 weeks for 25 minutes every Friday. Can't talk about that. I should surely be able to talk about frivolous stuff. I can talk about frivolous stuff. I just can't say the word frivolous. Is it frivolous? frivolous, frivolous. I can spell it. That's a start. I find I can't spell as well as I used to these days. I'd be writing my webcomic Matchstick Cats, which you can find at matchstickcats.com. And I keep having to check words, whether I'm spelling them properly. I used to know how things were spelt. And when I say I used to know how things were spelled, I don't mean I know how I spelled them. I know the correct spelling of them without looking it up. You young people say, just use the spell checker. I'm typing this into Microsoft Paint 3D, which I use on Windows, which I run in Parallels on my Mac Mini, a copy of Windows which I own for the sole purpose of using Windows Paint. So I'm typing the words into this Paint document, into my Matchstick Cats webcomic. There's no spell checker involved in there. I'm switching between that and the browser and Googling the word to check its spelling. It's good that I can spell frivolous, but my spelling is worse, or maybe it was worse all along and I just didn't notice. How would you know if your spelling is bad? It's like, how would you know if you're hallucinating? You wouldn't necessarily know. How would you know you're even alive? You might not be alive. You might be having some sort of after-death experience. You might be a ghost. You might have died 1,000 years ago and you spent the last 1,000 years stuck listening to this podcast over and over and over again and you're not even aware of it. You're like Bruce Willis in that movie Bruce Willis was in. I know he was in more than one movie, but you know what I mean. Haley Joel Osment is a gifted kid who can see dead people, and Bruce Willis is in it, not realizing he's, spoiler alert, dead. Eventually it finds out that he's dead. At least I think he does he? At least the audience finds out that he's dead. The audience has time to think about these things. Bruce Willis is busy. He doesn't have time to think about these things. And it's especially hard if you don't have a body or a brain anymore. He's just a ghost trying to help this child. And it never occurred to him that he might not be a person. He might be dead. He hasn't got time to think about it. We're sitting in the cinema watching this, watching his every move. We see camera angles that Bruce Willis can't see. Ghost or no ghost. Although you do hear sometimes from people who talk about near-death experiences, they say, oh, I was able to see from every angle. I had a bird's eye view, or whatever you call it. I could see in all directions. But Bruce Willis in this wasn't seeing from all the... Wait a minute, oh, no. Even if he could see in every direction, that doesn't mean he'd have the same camera view that we had looking at him. So if we're looking at him from behind in a scene, we can see the back of his head. Even if he has eyes in the back of his head, he doesn't see the same thing we're seeing. We see the eyes that he has in the back of his head. The eyes that are in the back of his head see us. And he probably thinks, oh, that's interesting. There's a camera there. I wonder what that's doing. I probably just think he lives in a surveillance state. Or else he thinks, so my wife got all these security cameras installed everywhere after I was shot and made a full recovery. That's great. There's cameras everywhere. Nothing unusual about that. It's good, though. It's good. It means I'm safe. Doesn't help that he has this weird kid. He's patient. Are you allowed to practice as a child psychologist when you're dead? That doesn't seem right. That stuff is all regulated. If someone not notice that some kid is being referred to some psychologist whose business doesn't exist anymore because he's dead, nobody asks any questions. That's Hollywood. Hollywood is full of shit. It's all full of absolute shit. Full of shit. And look what it's done to poor Bruce Willis now. He has a tragic degenerative condition. He's never going to be able to make a sequel to that, I can tell you. Not just because of his position, just because they didn't leave her open for a sequel. How would you have a sequel to that? I don't know. Maybe the kid grows up to be a child psychologist. No, the kid grows up to be an adult psychologist. He treats adults who have had near-death experiences. And he tells them, you may not have died, but I don't know what he tells them. I don't know. Would you want a child like that as their psychologist if you're an adult? I suppose he wouldn't, but he wouldn't be a child in that instance. It'd be like Gladiator. It'd be set at least 24 years later, a Gladiator sequel. The child would be about, I don't know, 32, 33. Oh, Christ, he'd be just the age Jesus was when he did all his preaching and then got crucified. I suppose that's not of any relevance, is it? No, it's just a coincidence. Anyway, I don't think they should make this sequel. People love to point out about that movie, The Sixth Sense. You watch it once, and then you have this big surprise reveal, and then you can watch it a second time with the knowledge that you got from the surprise reveal, and it's like watching a completely different movie. Well, it's even better if you actually are watching a completely different movie. You can have that experience as well. Watch The Sixth Sense once, and you get the surprise ending, and watch The Sixth Sense a second time. You see it from a whole different point of view, with this knowledge, everything looks different. And then you go, oh, I wish you could watch that a third time. But you can't, because there's nothing new to be gained from watching it a third time. So if you want another go, watch another Haley Joel Osment movie. That one where he's a robot. Artificial intelligence. Watch that then, and then you have a third view of that movie, where it's very, 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 very different. And that movie, Artificial Intelligence, that's like two movies in one, because you watch the first half and it's just him being a robot, and then you watch the second half and it's all this shit that happens hundreds of years later or something. I forget the exact details, which is probably good, because that means I can watch it again and not necessarily enjoy it, but appreciate the experience anew. Anyway, I think we're approaching the end of the program, so goodbye.